Welcome to the 132nd episode of Reverse Swept Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 10 years to the day since England declared on 517-1 at the Gabba. Welcome to the podcast for which heaven is watching Trott and Cook bat for 100 overs.
Yes, this is the world's only interhemispherical podcast. We haven't actually fact-checked that, so if someone wants to write in and let us know that it's not true, you're very welcome. We'd be glad of the correction. Andy's in a very foggy Oxfordshire, I can see behind you. I'm in Sydney, 42 degrees today, so we couldn't be further apart. But today, as ever, cricket is going to be bringing us together, including a fantastic feature from Andy on the Tendulkar run-out riots. And then, because there's nothing like variety, we're going to be reviewing Justin Parkinson's book, The Strange Death of English Leg Spin. Andy, you've been watching some footballers put on their cricket gear.
Yeah, so you'd never see footballers playing cricket is the traditional grumpy response to the sight of cricketers' much-loved warm-up game of football. People get very angry with this, the idea that, you know, you might turn your ankle with an over-enthusiastic
tackle. But a few people have.
Tackle.
I mean, that's fair. There have been some high-profile cases of people doing exactly that.
And to be fair, they have, but we'll brush effortlessly over that. This week, however, we finally saw the other side of this, as Premier League side Tottenham Hotspur relaxed after training with a cricket game. This has had quite the presence on Twitter, where the focus has been on Dele Alli's spectacular, if slightly lucky, catch. It sort of bounces off his leg and he then takes it. But I would heartily recommend the short 8-minute video. There are so many gems in here. We have England's captain and sort of all-round hero, Harry Kane, facing an LBW appeal. And rather wonderfully, he just stops, looks at where his leg is, and informs his teammates that he is not out. Which
it's
I
very
think is,
WG Grace. I mean,
it is a bit. It's very much the behaviour of the captain. Well, I think he's also saved by the fact that it's not clear that the level of cricket knowledge in the team is that high. So I think people are also willing to defer to him. I'm intrigued by the mystery where Eric Dyer, the midfielder, got some wicket-keeping gloves from, because mostly they're just playing in training kit. But he appears to have just found a perfectly good pair of wicket-keeping gloves. We have 100 million euro midfielder Gareth Bale taking a sharp one-handed catch in the slips and then looking very, very pleased with himself. But perhaps my personal favourite is Spanish defender Sergio Reguilón, who knows less than anyone what on earth is going on in this game, celebrates a wicket by enthusiastically sliding on his bum along the gym floor, which I think is a wonderful moment where he can see that something exciting has happened. He has no idea what it is, but he's determined.
But just wants to enter into the spirit. And it's actually a reminder as well that, you know, great sports people are, you know, if you're a great footballer, all of the same ingredients are going to make you pretty good at another sport. It's the same thing, you know, when you watch, when you see, you know, the England cricket side ribbing each other about how bad at football certain teammates are, that actually you watch them play. I mean, I'm no football expert, but you actually think they're actually pretty bloody good at it. It's probably the same kind of thing here. It's the same ingredients, isn't it?
It's totally infuriating, I think, for those of us who sort of you know, inch out every bit of sporting ability we've got. You see these people who can just turn their hand to any sport.
Yep.
There's the goalkeeper, Joe Hart, who apparently was actually a very talented young cricketer, bowling at pace. And you think, oh, you know, he is a proper cricketer. But as much fun as it was also great publicity for cricket. I mean, I think we all wish it were not so, but the fact is football has both the popularity and frankly a kind of coolness that cricket is often struggling to keep up with. So 500,000 views for a video of Premier League footballers playing cricket is good for the game.
And where is it? YouTube, Twitter? Where can you see it?
YouTube, yes. Yeah, YouTube, Twitter. The Tottenham Hotspur official YouTube feed. It can be found there.
There we go.
It's also, as an aside, and I would defer to people who are more Twitter literate than me, it seemed to have set off a bit of a trade-off between Tottenham players now corresponding with English cricketers on Twitter. So all very wholesome stuff.
That's what we'd like to see.
Yeah. And you have managed something that many, many cricket fans world have desperately missed and desperately looking forward to doing again.
Yeah, I went to see a game almost. So the Des Moines Oval is one of my favourite grounds here in Australia. Partly, I'll admit, that's because of the sheer convenience of it. There's a bus that goes outside my front door, and it's there in 20 minutes, so it's really handy to get to. But it's also because it's like a proper old-fashioned county ground. It's not a stadium at all. There are grass banks on three sides of the pitch. It's a proper kind of family ground. You feel like you are just a couple of yards away from the pitch. You can have a conversation with the players. I've seen, you know, England play tour games there. I've seen state games as well. And I was thrilled that there were a couple of women's BBL games being held there the week before last. So my partner, who actually, I don't think has ever listened to the podcast, but miraculously came down one morning and said, "Should we go to the women's BBL?" And I suddenly thought, I am marrying the right woman. So we decided, off we went, got on the bus, got there. And for some reason that hadn't actually been said on the website anywhere, and I assume is to do with COVID, the ground was actually shut. So they were playing it behind closed doors, as it were. But because of the setup of the game and the fact that it's kind of on the side of a hill, there was a collection of people who were just sitting outside the fence, but on the side of the hill, with actually quite a good view down into the ground.
Well, there's a long tradition of this, isn't there? You know, even in sort of pre-COVID days, the sort of the excellent views you can get often from outside the stadium, and often they're the people who the TV cameras most love, you know.
Well,
the diligent
exactly.
People on the hill or in the tree nearby.
Yeah, or you know, at the Oval you see those flats that are there.
Oh, so
the
jealous.
I mean, I think the key benefit to that is that you're not restricted on the amount of alcohol that you can take in or made to drink bad beer when you're in the ground. You can just stock the fridge up, get your mates over and have a great old time with a decent loo on hand while watching the cricket. So look, this was a little bit different. You had to sort of position yourself on the grass so that you could look through the sort of slats in the fence and make sure that you could see both the bowler in their delivery stride and the batsman sort of at the same time. But there was just this beautiful sense of camaraderie, because there was a kind of cohort of, I mean, there must have sort of been sort of three or four dozen people there for each game, and we stayed for both. There was one at 9:30 in the morning and one at 2:30 in the afternoon, and there were, you know, a lot of fathers with their daughters and sons. There were some hardcore cricket nuts who were out there with their scorecards, you know, who really wanted to keep up with what was happening in the competition. And then there was also a group of families of the players as well, but everyone was kind of mixed in together in a really lovely way. And it just struck me that one of the things that's said about the women's game, and sometimes it's said a little bit patronisingly, is that there's a lack of cynicism to it, that actually it's not about people just eking out an existence and they're slightly over, you know, cricket. There's actually this genuine sense of joy of playing the game and wanting to be a part of it. And you really saw this in a beautiful way here, this group of people who just wanted to be somewhere watching these top-notch players in action and were just going to do anything they could to make that happen.
And do you think you'll be hearing again the words from your partner, "Let's go to the game this morning"?
Well, I think we should do everything we can to encourage that kind of behaviour. But it's certainly a great advert for a form of cricket that's not the often quite kind of loud, macho side that 2020 can be. There was something that was just a really beautiful day out. Admittedly, she spent her entire time reading her book and barely watching the cricket. But you know, you get them in the gate however you can.
That's a perfectly legitimate way to watch cricket.
It truly is. From the archives and this episode, Andy is going to take us back 21 years to the Tendulkar run-out riots.
The February 99 test at Eden Gardens between India and Pakistan had the biggest crowd of any test in history. That record still has not been broken. Close to 500,000 people turned up over the five days.
A lot of people.
It is ridiculous.
That's an extraordinary number of people when you just think about that 500,000 stat. But yeah. Anyway, I've derailed your story one sentence in.
No, it is quite extraordinary. And also the fact that the record has endured. It was the first ever game of the short-lived Asian Test Championship, which involved just these two rivals and Sri Lanka, and it was a game worthy of this record-breaking crowd. So Pakistan collapsed to 26 for 6, but they rally to 185 all out. India are in control at 147 for 2, going well, before the arrival of the Rawalpindi Express. And please, please go and look this up, because these are two wonderful deliveries. Shoaib Akhtar dismisses Rahul Dravid with a Yorker that swerves outrageously late before dipping and removing leg stump. A ball later, he does very similar to Tendulkar, and this time it's middle stump that was flattened. Well worth watching, because I still can't decide, am I looking at a sort of magic full toss or a Yorker? They're really unusual deliveries, but they are high pace and they are moving.
And you look at them and you think, there is just absolutely no way you could play them as well. And it seems to be the reaction of the batsman at the same time, that just they're freakish balls in the way that Akhtar could come up with every now and again. Just
absolutely.
The free
balls. Well, there's something about that concept of being a clutch player, you know, keeping your very best for the big moments. And there was always something of that to show about Akhtar. And I think particularly with this, to do that to Dravid and Tendulkar at that moment. So India, in the end, thanks to that, are restricted to a lead of just 38. Pakistan make 316 this time and leave India 279 to win. In a near replica of the first innings, India are going well again. They're on 143 for 2, on track. Tendulkar then punches a Wasim Akram delivery to deep mid-wicket, and substitute fielder Nadeem Khan sets off in pursuit. Akram, a bit lazily actually, doesn't get behind the stumps to take the return throw, so Shoaib Akhtar does. Tendulkar is jogging the third, and then at the very last moment, he starts to hurry. He's looking at the fielder, not at the crease, and he crashes hard into Akhtar, and the throw hits directly. We go straight to the third umpire. Akhtar's on his knees, clutching his back. It's actually clearly been relatively painful to have a high-speed Tendulkar running into your back. Tendulkar looks fairly relaxed. He goes off, has a natter with Rahul Dravid. But the replay shows very clearly that when the ball strikes the stumps, Tendulkar is mid-collision. His feet are outside the crease, his bat's in the air. The red light goes on, Tendulkar walks off.
So his bat is over the crease, but it's in the air.
That's right.
So that's kind of why he's feeling confident, because he feels like, I've made my ground, but it's effectively the grounding of the bat that's the thing that kind of undoes him in that regard.
That's right, and he, you know, his feet clearly aren't in, but I think you're right to say his confidence would have been because he knew his bat was over the line. And I think, you know, this is not the first time we've seen incidents in which, in some cases, there's been bad luck. Well, there's been laziness of the bat being raised. In others, you've occasional freak incident. You have the bat almost bouncing and sort of being lifted at the key moment.
Well, because they had to change the law, didn't they? So that if you'd actually grounded it and it came up again, you were still in.
You're still in, yes.
Whereas anyway, that's too much of a detail. What happens
well,
next?
Well, no, these are the details that were pretty crucial for India and Sachin Tendulkar. The crowd, however, were less interested in the details. They began to roar cheat at Shoaib and pelted him with bottles. I love the fact that the giant screen imploringly asks that Calcutta loves cricket, please maintain the Eden's tradition, which did not have much of an impact on the crowd. Facing this first of the riots, the players leave the field for an early tea. Tendulkar, the ICC president, Jagmohan Dalmia, and a motley crew of soldiers and policemen take a lap of the outfield to try to calm the crowd down.
How does that work? So you have an ICC president who's an absolute nobody, frankly, who no one in the crowd's going to have any idea, plus Tendulkar, plus soldiers and policemen. They're just walking around. What kind of gesticulating, sort of sit down, or are they sort of making? Tendulkar got a megaphone and he's kind of making a, because in a way, if you've just got someone walking in front of a crowd, that could see as an excitement. Look, this is the man that's been unfairly, you know, got out. It's an odd one, and I wouldn't want to be in the position of having to handle that crowd at that moment and work out how to calm them down.
I think what I would love to know is the conversation that happened with Tendulkar, because presumably someone has had to go into the Indian dressing room to say, look, we think you're the only person who can calm the crowd down. Will you calm? And Tendulkar Tendulkar probably has things he would rather be doing.
He's halfway through a shower or something and he gets plucked out.
Well, he's also probably quite irritated, frankly. Yeah. You know, there's that side of it as well. He has clearly... There's not much more planned to this than walking round and sort of making calming hand gestures.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. There's no great master plan. I don't, to my knowledge, although happy to be corrected, I certainly haven't seen on any of the video footage evidence that there was any speech given. I think it really was just trying to calm people down. I will just quote the head of the local police, who said that he was grateful for Sachin's efforts and noted with, I think, unmerited satisfaction, fortunately, we had not allowed spectators to bring in anything lethal, which I think if you're a police force is setting a pretty low bar for your achievements, but
He's probably there just thinking, thank God, when I was filling out the security form for this thing, I didn't tick the let lethal stuff in box. You know, it's just an amazing kind of arse covering as much as anything else.
So were these angry Indian fans justified? Obstructing the batsman as a fielder comes under Law 41, which is the law on unfair play. And the law is very clear that this is an offence only if the fielder obstructs the batsman willfully. There's clearly nothing willful about Sherbakhtar's obstruction. He got into position very early and he was on the edge of the pitch, so he left plenty of room for Tendulkar. The little master was unlucky, but he was responsible. He wasn't looking, he wasn't running hard until that very last moment. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, how many run-outs come back to that. It's the fact that you're not actually running very hard, and then you run hard and try to save the day.
Well, exactly. You don't have enough time to kind of swerve around. Because the other thing is that the bowler doesn't actually have to... Well, neither the bowler nor the batsman have to actually move. If you're standing still, you're not obliged to actually get out of the way of anyone else. You can just carry on standing there, can't you?
Exactly. And I also think, you know, you'd have more sympathy in a scenario where perhaps Sherb got there very, very late or was right in the middle of the pitch, but neither were true. Indian newspapers sort of stoked the flames on this by saying that Wasim Akram, the Pakistani captain, should have withdrawn the appeal. I think it's interesting to note that in the immediate aftermath, there's no suggestion that Tendulkar asked him to do so or any of the Indian players asked him to do so. And I don't think it was considered at the time. So after this delay and Tendulkar's peacekeeping mission, the game resumes. India finished the day on 214 for six. Final day, 65 needed, 4 wickets in hand, Sourav Ganguly and the tail to get them. It's a good finish. It's well set up. But sadly for India, it's effectively over just 19 balls into this final day. By that point, India are 9 down, Ganguly's gone. And with the game all but lost, riot number 2 begins. So Wisden speaks of spectators burning newspapers, hurling stones, fruit and more bottles. By this point, you think Sherbakhtar is probably getting pretty sick of being had at him.
And also fruit is a wonderfully calm thing to actually do. You know, maybe the police commissioner was proud that he'd given everyone a piece of fruit to throw, something nice.
Well, I don't know that. I mean, I don't want a sort of, you know, apple connecting with the back of... Well, I mean, I suppose...
It's not as bad as a rock, though. I mean, it's
you're right. If you give me a choice between being stoned or appled, I would probably take the apples. So this time the police and security have decided enough's enough. There will be no attempt to calm the crowd down. They're just going to clear the ground, which takes 3 hours. Not surprising when you've got, you know, another big crowd in at Eden's Gardens. Wisden states that the crowd's anger was still concentrated on Tendulkar's run-outs. There was little viciousness of the riot. It was born of disappointment rather than anti-Pakistan feeling. I mean, this is interesting journalism in that I'm not really sure how you can, from a crowd of that size, kind of make an assessment of the cause of the riot. But I think it's not unreasonable to imagine that, given a lot of these people would have read the coverage overnight about how it was all Pakistan's fault for running out Tendulkar, I think it's a reasonable assessment. It takes Pakistan just 10 balls to complete the victory when they finally come back after this 3 hours. And after this crowd that has been at capacity size for 5 days, they do so in front of a near empty stadium. I'll give the final words to India's captain, Mohammad Azharuddin. I just want them to behave, because every time we cannot win. We are also human beings, and any day we can fail. This incident has let us down in the world of cricket, and I don't know why they did that. To the review, and for this episode we've been reading The Strange Death of English Leg Spin by Justin Parkinson. It was published in June 2015. Justin Parkinson writes on politics and industrial relations for the BBC. This is his second cricket book, following Then Came the Massacre, his biography of Maurice Tate. The book tells the history of the struggles of English leg spin through the stories of its bowlers. Now, what did you learn here about the origins of leg spin?
This was, I think, one of the book's strengths, is kind of opening chapters talking about the way that this art that we now think of as being owned by other cricketing countries around the world actually originated in England. And Parkinson takes us on a bit of a journey through some of the characters who came up with it and some of the kind of serendipity as well that surrounded it. You know, this idea of the game of twisty-twosty, which he actually advocates for the return of at the end of the book, where you kind of spin a ball on a table with your wrist, and that kind of generated some of the different ways of using, you know, of effectively wrist spin bowling. The thing that I think really struck with me was just how hit and miss leg spin bowling was accepted to be in its origins at the end of the 19th century. You know, you'd had international bowlers who would frequently just not be able to land it on the pitch at all. Pelham Warner apparently became so embarrassed by the number of balls that Bosanquet, one of the great early leg spinners, bowled that would bounce multiple times before they reached the batsman, that he actually stopped picking Bosanquet for his team.
Well, it also showed this problem with trying something new when Bosanquet himself was incredibly embarrassed by it as well at times. Yeah. And you thought this is the risk where these like good ideas can die at that early stage, just because people are anxious about being seen to be foolish, basically.
Well, particularly because it was seen as being a moral thing too. There was an idea that leg spin, because it was somehow deceptive or different, was seen as being immoral. And so actually it became, you know, this idea that you could be a sturdy pace bowler, or you could be an off spinner, but that leg spin was somehow sort of a little bit perverted. So the book obviously takes us a narrative through the a number of pen portraits of cricketers, a lot of whom I'd never actually really heard of, but in Parkinson's eyes are the kind of, the people who should be thought of as the English lineage of leg spin bowlers, but never quite get there. Who were the names that jumped out to you?
Well, I think there were sort of old and new, weren't there? I mean, I was reminded of more recently of the extraordinary story of Chris Schofield, who I think does remain a remarkable story. I mean, one of the original English players to get a central contract ended up only ever playing a single test.
Yes.
And I think Parkinson clearly has this great affection for these sort of nearly men. And I think it's a little bit like the Stephen Chalke book we reviewed recently, that he sees it as part of his mission to try and interview as many of these people and get their story recorded. And they're quite poignant stories, because perhaps you can say this about any career, but particularly in a sporting career, these things turn on tiny margins. You know, the coach who doesn't give them the chance, the decisive game where they needed to do something and they didn't. But you were quite struck with the story of someone who took quite a gamble to take his career forward.
Yeah, so I knew kind of the name of Ian Peebles, but I didn't know too much about his background. So a Scotsman originally who decided to move down to London in order to enroll at the kind of great cricketing academy of the day, sort of set up in a garage in London, who, according to people at the time and according to Parkinson's analysis as well, was kind of the heir to Sydney Barnes, the great English leg spinner. And there's this kind of tragic story where Peebles, you know, would put in the hours in the nets and would refine his technique, but then when he got out into the middle, he just couldn't hack it. You know, there were times when he would just be unable to bowl, other times where he'd show a flash of brilliance, including befuddling Don Bradman. But that on the whole, and this is, I think, is a recurring theme through the book, the fact that actually being a leg spinner is such a mental game as much as anything, that it's really hard to do, that it goes wrong regularly, and that you need a certain type of character that can put up with that.
And Peebles' career brings out that point, but also another sort of paradox with leg spin, which is that at Aubrey Faulkner's academy, he was over bowled, and this seems to have done real damage to his shoulder. But at the same time, you read other leg spinners saying, look, the only way you can master this is by bowling a ton load of overs. And you think, where is this sort of happy medium between the two?
And a lot of people who just weren't given enough of a chance, for instance, when they got into the, you know, particularly late in the book, recent English leg spinners who get into the team and then are just never given a bowl because captains are too worried of them going for too many runs, so they just don't get enough of a bowl. So obviously that the theme of the whole book is about, you know, how English leg spin has failed. What struck you as being the key reasons? What's the silver bullet that killed English leg spin?
Well, I don't. I guess if there is a silver bullet, it's mistrust, isn't it? I think the strongest theme that comes out again and again is this idea that English cricketers and perhaps particularly English captains didn't trust it. There's this particularly good phrase around Len Hutton, who just did not believe that leg spin could work in the north of England. I think Parkinson's analysis is outstanding. I mean, there's certain things that I'd never been aware of. So the fact that, for example, in the as early as the 1940s and 50s, English counties were employing a lot of Australian leg spinners. My one really small challenge to the approach here is I just think we could dig a bit deeper. And I wonder whether Parkinson clearly has done the thinking. And I just wonder whether some of these causes, like the psychology of English captains and the conservatism, we could do a little bit more. You know, was there perhaps another way of structuring this book where perhaps being less historical, we actually take a chapter on the conservatism of English county captains and try and approach it from that angle?
That's interesting because, I mean, one of the anecdotes that really jumped out at me was the when Ian Salisbury first plays with Jack Russell. Jack Russell says shortly before the game, look, we're going to have to work out a kind of semaphore system because I actually can't pick any of your variations. So when you get to the top of your mark, you know, you need to cough twice or whatever it is if you're going to bowl a googly and cough three times if you're bowling a flipper. And Ian Salisbury's just kind of, hang on, I'm trying to make my debut here and bowl properly and I'm having to think about how I communicate, you know, discreetly to the wicketkeeper about what I'm about to bowl, which is an interesting anecdote. But again, to the point that you're making, I think, Andy, it would be really interesting to think a bit more about what actually underlies that as a reason why it is that you have a top class glove man who's actually coming out and saying, I'm unable to pick a spinner and sorry, it's all on you, mate.
But that's it, isn't it? It's the wrong way around. Like, surely there's something on Jack Russell there. There were also some rule changes, which I had never really thought about in terms of the change in the LBW rule, which really helped off spinners because the fact that you could be out if the ball hit outside off but not outside leg. Similarly, the changing rules around when you could take a new ball. So, you know, the more new balls you can use, frankly, the less effective or the less useful spin might be seen as. I guess the only challenge on some of these is the extent to which you're dealing with kind of international phenomena that were true in every country. I wondered whether it would be a little bit more honest of Parkinson to admit that actually leg spin globally had some real struggles as well. Yeah. You know, Abdul Qadir and Shane Warne, they weren't just great figures in Pakistan and Australia. You know, they saved leg spin kind of, many people feel they saved leg spin kind of around the world. So I think we can be kind of tough on what the English did to our heritage of leg spin, but I think there's probably challenges that go across the whole game.
There was also, and I mean, this is going to sound both heretic and probably a bit stupid, but there was another question that kind of kept on coming back to me through the book, which was kind of, well, why bother with leg spin then? You know, this thing of, if it's so hard to bowl and we're basically admitting that it can go wrong quite a lot of the time, and that there have only been one or two people in history, you know, or at least a handful of people in history have been able to do it really well. I would actually have been really interested in a bit of analysis of, okay, so why does England need, therefore, to cultivate a great leg spinner? How is our national setup going to be better if we have leg spinners in them? Apart from the simple sort of theoretical idea of keeping leg spinners in the game for the sake of keeping leg spinners in the game.
I totally agree. And I think there is a bit of honesty here at points where I think Parkinson does admit, look, there is something romantic about this. There is something that actually there is a joy to watching leg spin. But you've also got to be honest about the fact that you look at, say, that fantastic England team of 2005 and beyond. You know, they did other stuff as well. I mean, that England team was a traditional England team in the sense that what did it rely on bowling-wise? Well, it relied on swing, didn't it? I mean, there was one spinner who, you know, not being unkind to Ashley Giles, but, you know, was not a great turner of the ball.
The king of Spain rather than the king of spin, yeah.
Right. And I think you know, your challenge is a really good one, which is that it has been possible to build very successful cricket teams without a leg spinner, and that's why many teams have been able to regard it as a luxury.
So, look, I really enjoyed reading this book overall. I have to say, I didn't think I was going to because the cover is puzzling, I have to say. It doesn't make you necessarily pluck it off the shelf, but I would urge you to get past that. I think we would both urge you to get past that because it's definitely worth a read, and you will meet some characters that certainly I hadn't come across before, and some anecdotes and some thoughts that were new and were interesting as well. So that is The Strange Death of English Legspin, not a Miss Marple, but a book by Justin Parkinson. And that was the 132nd episode of Reverse Retro Radio. We'll be back in a few weeks' time for our Christmas special. I think I've just committed us to having a Christmas special of some description. We will, as ever, jump over onto Twitter to send us your thoughts, and head to iTunes to leave us a 5-star review.